So if I could define the general manager's job into two things, it would be crisis management and decision making under uncertainty.
Hello, and welcome to the Decision Education Podcast, where we talk to experts and share tips on all things related to decision making. I'm your season two guest host, Annie Duke, broadcasting from the Alliance for Decision Education, the educational nonprofit committed to the understanding that better decisions lead to better lives and a better society. In this season, we're turning our attention to decision making in the world of high performance sports. My hope is that through these conversations, you'll start to think differently about the critical role of decision making in the competitive sports we follow so passionately, as well as discover practical ways to improve your own decision making. Imagine what a difference it would make in your life and the lives of those you love if we were all even a little bit better at making decisions. The Alliance is building a national movement to bring decision education to every student in this country. But this podcast is for you, the adults, who are already out in the world making thousands of decisions every day and who want to get better at it.
Producer's note. Since the recording of this conversation, Andrew Berry has joined the board of the Alliance for Decision Education.
I'm excited to welcome my guest today, Andrew Berry. Andrew is the general manager and executive vice president of football operations for the Cleveland Browns. His appointment at the age of 32 made Andrew the youngest person to hold the title of general manager in NFL history. And in his first year as GM, the Browns made it to the playoffs for the first time in 18 years. Andrew studied economics and computer science at Harvard, and in 2009, he turned down a job offer with Goldman Sachs to take an entry-level position for the Indianapolis Colts. Over his career to date, he has worked with the Colts, the Cleveland Browns, and the Philadelphia Eagles, finally returning back to the Browns in 2020 as GM. In June 2020, Berry started the Be the Solution campaign to emphasize education and encourage staff, fans, players, and the media to implement action for ending social and racial injustice practices. Hi, Andrew. I'm so excited to have you here.
I'm excited to be here, Annie. I appreciate you for having me.
Well, we've known each other, for 2 years?
Yes.
So I got to know you a little bit at Philadelphia, and now you're back at the Browns. Boo-hoo for Philadelphia. But, obviously, we have a little bit of history, but what I would love for people who don't have our history is for you just to start off by telling us a little bit about really what you do and how you got to this path of, you know, at the age of 32, becoming GM of an NFL team, which is a harder thing to get than like Senator of the United States.
Well, I don't know about that. And I definitely got a little bit lucky along the way. I guess I would be remiss if I didn't start to say that I think anybody who gets into one of these positions, and particularly in sports, if you ask 10 people, there are probably 10 different stories in terms of their path. And for me, you know, I consider myself very blessed and very fortunate. So I grew up in a household where basically education and football were at the forefront. You know, both my parents were the first people in their families to graduate college. My dad was a huge diehard Cowboys fan, raised me and my brother to be Cowboys fans. My mom, you know, she was a chemical engineer in college and had played hoops, but, you know, grew up as a Falcons fan. So sports and education were really big in our household. So grew up playing all sorts of sports, and football was, of course, my favorite. Went to college at Harvard and was a corner on the football team. Like all college athletes, probably, I had hoped to have a shot to play in the NFL. I was a marginal NFL prospect, made it to rookie minicamp coming out, but didn't make it that far past that. And at the time, after I was graduating, I had interned and then accepted a job to do sales and trading for Goldman Sachs. Well, I wasn't super excited about going there, if I'm being honest, because it wasn't necessarily my passion. And my first boss in the NFL was a gentleman named Tom Telesco. He was the scouting director of the Colts at the time. He's currently the general manager for the LA Chargers. He had been on a scouting trip at Harvard and became familiar with my background story and just kind of reached out and said, hey, have you ever thought working in football or an NFL front office? Because we think your background would be a nice fit. And I really hadn't, but he said, hey, we have this entry-level position open as a scouting assistant. We'd like you to come interview for it. So I really kind of went on the interview more as a courtesy because I accepted this job in New York. I didn't know much about the industry. And in the preparation for the interview, I was like, you know what? This actually feels like what I'm actually, searching for, like something that I would really enjoy doing professionally. I was fortunate enough to go through the interview process, receive an offer. And then at that point, meeting everybody in Indianapolis, I just did an about face. I was just like, you know what? I think this is more me than what I had intended to do maybe a few weeks earlier. And so from there, I was very lucky that I started my career under one of two general managers who were in the Hall of Fame, Bill Polian, and spent my first 7 years in Indianapolis and really kind of did everything at probably like lower or junior levels within football operations, pro scouting, college scouting, operations, learned contract management. And ultimately, before I left, was overseeing the pro department and kind of the number two in contract management and helping us get our first, research and strategy group off the ground. And from there, I was fortunate to go to Cleveland under Sashi Brown, who was the general manager at the time. He was running basically an open search for a personnel director because he had been newly named the general manager. Sashi had a legal background, had been their general counsel, had run contract management, very, very smart guy, and was taking a very progressive approach to team building. And again, I didn't know Sashi the first time. I was fortunate, like most general managers, they get in those positions, they really hire people that they know. And Sashi took a gamble on a 28-year-old personnel director. And it was one of the best environments for me because of everything I learned. Spent 3 years there, left for a year and worked under Howie Roseman, who I think is one of the best general managers in our sport, another guy who had a bit of a non-traditional background into the industry. And then from there, when Cleveland turned over their management group, I guess a little bit over a year ago, I was fortunate to come back and interview with ownership and receive the offer. And it's been a really nice, 14 or so months to start. So,
yeah. Oh gosh. Okay. So there's so many things that are coming to mind for me right now. So okay. I don't even know where to start, but let me start just with something that I think from my perspective, thinking about my life, mm-hmm. I had the benefit of kind of accidentally finding a particular area in which the things that I had been studying could express themselves in a very unusual mm-hmm. way. So I was studying cognitive science, which also includes really understanding data and mm-hmm. Statistics and probability theory. And then I accidentally kind of ended up in poker. And yeah. I'm hearing that in your thinking. And I think for me, the collision of those two backgrounds really ended up informing the way that I think about the world. So I know for you, obviously you were thinking, you accepted a job actually mm-hmm. at Goldman Sachs. And when you were at Harvard, you studied computer science, which is mm-hmm. a very particular analytical way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And then when I hear you saying, okay, so you land with the scouts, mm-hmm. the thing that I always hear about in organizations yeah. is that there's kind of turf fights. Like if I yes. think about like West Side Story with like the Jets versus the Sharks. And one of those turf fights, I feel, is between the analytics department and the scouts. And that there's this kind of fight that happens. So I'd love to sort of hear your thinking about having come from a world that was more in the analytics side. And in mm-hmm. fact, that seemed to be the path that you were going to end up on, going into at Goldman Sachs. You now end up in the scouting department. Mm-hmm. So how did you think about the way that merged? What was the scouting department at the Colts like? Was there this kind of turf fight? And how does that kind of inform your thinking as you go forward?
Yeah, it's a good and interesting question, Annie, because I think you're capturing, and not just in sports, but across many organizations where there is maybe a little bit of this natural tension between some more subjective measures and some more data-driven measures. And for me, you'll probably hear me say this 1,000 times in this podcast, like I was lucky with my background and the time in our industry when I came in. I mean that for a couple of reasons. So yeah, I got my master's in computer science and my bachelor's in economics at Harvard, but I was also at the time a 1AA football player who had gotten far enough to be in rookie minicamp for an NFL team. So for me, when I came in to an organization to really kind of cut my teeth in scouting, I didn't necessarily have the same stigmas as maybe some of my peers around the league that had similar academic backgrounds, because it was like, okay, well, he's a you know, for lack of a better term, like a quote unquote football guy, because he played in, not only did he just play at this, even though it's not like a Power Five conference, it's like, oh, well, he actually was a pretty good player. He was actually in our scouting database. So like it gave me like right, wrong, or indifferent, and probably more wrong than anything. Like it, I didn't have to like tear down those, maybe some of those stereotypes initially, you know, when I got in. The second piece of it is, even though, and when I was getting into the NFL at the time, although data has been a huge part of baseball and basketball decision-making for a number of years now, football is still relatively new from the perspective of using some of the more like advanced methodologies to incorporate into their decision-making, right? You'll see, you know, predictive analysis, regression analysis in, you know, baseball, basketball, but really it's only taken off in really the past couple of years, at least in a widespread manner in the industry. So when I got in, like in the path is like, hey, if you want to run a team one day, you really have to know personnel. Like scouting really was the place to start. And it probably wasn't until year 5 or 6 in Indianapolis when we really dipped our toe in the water in terms of maybe building out, you know, a research and strategy group. So I didn't necessarily have the same uphill battle, probably at least till later in my career. Cause then, you know, really then the narrative shifted after my first, you know, my first stop in Cleveland, and I was further removed from my playing career. But at least initially on, it probably helped that I was, you know, quote unquote, one of the guys or one of the scouts, you know, coming up, that I never really had to like tear apart any of those stigmas to, you know, to get a point across or kind of propose a different way of looking at things.
So when you first went to the Colts, did they have an analytics department?
Did not. And I would say most teams in the NFL did not, which is crazy to say because that was like 10, 11 years ago. It's not, you know, it's not like this was 30 years ago, but really it was considered, okay, that was a thing that works in baseball and basketball. That's not a football thing, you know, at this point in time. So there wasn't really a heavy presence.
So, you know, one of the things that I think about in decision-making is you have, you know, what's true, which is essentially like, what are the things that you know? What are kind of the facts on the ground? And then you have subjective judgments that you make mm-hmm. on top of that. And I'd love to just sort of hear your thoughts on how people then and then today are thinking about the interaction between those two things. Because one of the things that I find is that when you get into a world where things clearly are more subjective, and this is true in any type of decision making. Some decision making is going to be just, you know, if you know the data, you've got the answer. And then you have other decision making, like hiring decisions, for mm-hmm. example, where you can have some data that's informing it, but obviously the answer is going to be quite subjective in the end. That, you know, I sort of find that what people end up doing is they sort of take sides, and they either are, the data is giving me the truth and stop with your judgment.
Yeah.
Right. Or my gut is telling me what to do and stop with your data. So I just love to hear your thoughts because you've been there sort of during the evolution. First of all, what was that like in the beginning and where is the NFL today on that issue?
Yeah. So early on, it was very much like your West Side Story, you know, just two competing camps basically shouting at one another like that. That's how I would describe it more industry wide, and largely because I think that, you know, one, the data perspective was different. And then I think two, probably how maybe some of that information was communicated to people who maybe haven't had as much experience with it was a challenge. And then I think three, like there was a fair amount of, because football, at least let's say relative to hoops or baseball, there is a lot more like gray in terms of what are hardcore facts. There was a fair amount of football wisdom that may have been too casually dismissed at times early on, that it led to maybe this natural tension between what I'll call the two competing camps. And then I think in some places it got to a point where it's like, all right, well, what percentage, like if we're going to make a decision, what percentage should we rely on subjective? What percentage should we rely on data? And I think, you know, some organizations still operate in that mindset, in that manner, when oftentimes that's not the right question, because it's not like, number one, it's not like one side's always right, one side's always wrong. And just to even think of them as sides, I think is the wrong mentality. And then the second piece is like, it really depends on the question that you're asking, how you're going to weight different inputs that go into decision-making. I think the league at this point has evolved into having a greater understanding in terms of how to use, you know, all pieces of data. But I think there still are gaps in it, a couple of reasons. I think the first area where the NFL has seen growth relative to the other sports is, I would say, just on the analysis side. Like, I think we've got to the point where you have the quality of analysis, whether it's in terms of methodologies or people, where you have those experts in the sport who add real value. I think the two areas where the league as a whole is still kind of either catching up or, you know, some teams may be a little bit further ahead than others. Number one is information quality, because the analysis is only good as, you know, the information that you're able to gather. And I would argue that probably baseball is furthest along relative to all the major sports. And it's probably perhaps a little bit easier because it's really a game of discrete events, whereas, mm-hmm. you know, hoops and the NFL, it's not quite the case. You know, hoops has been able to kind of discretize their game because of player tracking data. And, you know, you only have 10 players on the court. You know, football is still making inroads there just because there's a lot more complexity, but teams are, you know, advancing the ball, so to speak, in that area.
Just to be clear for people who don't, who maybe don't know the difference, if you think about baseball, it's basically like 9 independent people on the field.
Right.
You know, one person is hitting the ball, another person is pitching. So there's not as much interaction between the players. So that's where, and each play is very discrete. There's nothing, it's not as continuous, so that you can actually isolate out, you know, if you're thinking about a particular player, you can isolate them so much better from the rest of the team in terms of understanding how you're supposed to think about that player in a way that it's very hard to in football with 22 people on the field all interacting with each other, right?
Exactly. So I think that's something that's a frontier that teams are making a lot of progress on. We're not all the way there yet, but a lot of progress on. But then I think actually the major hurdle, and I think this is largely, call it alignment, relationship, buy-in driven, is from a decision-making standpoint. So let's assume we're in a world where we have ideal data, we have world-renowned analysts, and we're able to combine all the different pieces of information, scouting report, medical information, you know, objective data, performance data, you name it. And it gets that information and analysis gets to, you know, really any of the, you know, decision makers in the respective places, whether it's, you know, a coach, a general manager, you know, you name it, and it doesn't actually inform decision making of the organization, then it doesn't amount to anything. Like you can have the best data, best analyst, but if it doesn't inform decision making, it doesn't amount to anything. And so I think those two areas, the actual data quality and informing decisions, that's probably the areas that have grown a lot over the past decade, but there probably still is some room to grow within the sport.
And do you find big differences among teams? I mean, it feels like just from kind of a fan standpoint, there's a lot of pressure on teams to now have really robust analytics departments. But, you know, kind of to your point, I mean, I'm thinking back to you saying, well, you know, one of the advantages you had coming into the scouting department, despite the fact that you're secretly an egghead.
Right? That's fair. That's fair, Annie.
I mean, I am too. So consider it a compliment. You had football cred, right? Mm-hmm. They were like, he's a football guy, right? Mm-hmm. Is that they're still, I mean, obviously the NFL is still rife with kind of like old school, mm-hmm. you know, the old school who are like, stop with your analytics. So like you know, the thing that you always hear is like scouts are like, he looks like a football player, mm-hmm. right? He looks like the position. They feel like they can sort of see that. So while there's been a lot of pressure from fans to make sure that, you know, every team has to have a robust analytics department, really, what do you see as the tension? Is there still tension between analytics and scouting, but then also between, there's different styles of coaches, right, mm-hmm. who are more or less open to that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what are you kind of seeing around the league?
I don't think that tension is quite as pronounced as maybe it's perceived to be externally. I think largely because at the more junior levels of your organization or your scouting department, your coaching staff, those are usually people who are a little bit younger. And I think you really are seeing a wave of people that are coming into the sport that, you know, while an individual may not necessarily have been a quant at any point in his or her life, there is an appreciation for data because now people are consuming the sport or growing up in the sport with more data and more good publicly available data than I certainly did, you know, whether I was in high school or college or even early in my career. And so I think there's a greater appreciation for using that to make decisions or evaluate players or something along those lines. I think the level of tension is probably different from organization to organization. And I think a big part of it is maybe how you incorporate the different disciplines. Like ideally you want to, from my perspective, you want to integrate them really from the ground up, that they're partnered together and there's perspective and wisdom shared on both sides. Because really, the goal is the same, right? Like, you know, whether you're building a draft board or free agency board, whether you're trying to build a set of rules for in-game decision making, like that's going to take input from all the respective areas in your football operation. And, you know, rather than saying, okay, hey, what do you recommend? What do you recommend? And try and like merge it at the top. I think it makes sense to really kind of grow it together, but not everybody necessarily will, you know, will take that approach. So I think if in areas where perhaps where it is a little bit more siloed, I think that may be tension that, you know, I certainly observed, call it 7-8 years ago, probably still exists. But I think a lot of operations are probably a little further along than people give it credit for. I do think that there may be a little bit of a gap still as you go from, call it, the more junior or mid-levels of the organization to moving some of that content up to the decision-making realm. So just part of it is because, you know, generally speaking, those are more senior people in the organization who have been in the business longer and may not have quite as strong of a feel for some of the new information or integration of data with maybe traditional methods. But that being said, I do think the industry is evolving.
So I'm interested, you know, I see this kind of like, I mean, it's interesting when you think about across your career, you see in the evolution of the integration of really thinking about what are best practices in terms of decision-making, how do we incorporate data and analytics into our decision-making. So that's one kind of tension that it sounds like is starting to get resolved. But I think about this other type of tension, which is between the kind of external pressures, mm-hmm. which, you know, let's talk about the fans, the media, mm-hmm. but then I guess in some organizations that would also include the owner.
Yeah,
possibly.
I think that's fair, yeah.
And the people who are bought into this type of thinking, who do say that we can really structure great decisions and we can think about it, we can create repeatable processes, we can reduce the effect of cognitive bias, we can make our decisions less noisy. But, you know, then you know, obviously I famously opened a book with one of these, ponderings of, you know, which obviously was back in 2015, so maybe less buy-in back then, but people are still mad about it. Where the analytics or the way that you think about it from a decision analysis standpoint would bring you to one solution, but it's really out of the box. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't work out, there's just a lot of career risk that goes along with that. Yeah. So now you're in a position where you're dealing with that career risk. I mean, I sort of think about the evolution of your career. And as you've been learning along the way, you've also had a lot of protection, mm-hmm. right? Like if something happened and things didn't go well at the Eagles, it was going to be Howie Roseman who was mm-hmm. going to get the flack for it, or Doug Peterson. But you got to sort of sit behind and do your thing and integrate all of these things in the way that you wanted to. But now you're the one who's sitting out there mm-hmm. and you're the one who's going to catch the flack. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how you think about, how do you deal with that kind of, you know, internal to the organization where you may have really good alignment internally versus how do you think about the decision with what the external risks are?
No, that's a great question. So I'll talk about it from, call it, a outside the box perspective, where if it doesn't work, you know, it ends up being a scarlet letter, so to speak. And then I'll also talk about it from maybe a time horizon perspective. So I'll start with the first. So that doesn't bother me anymore. And it used to. And a big reason is because when I was here the first time, that was essentially what happened, right?
Yeah.
We had a stretch of, you know, 1-31. And although I wasn't the general manager, I was part of the senior decision-making group. And going through that experience, right, you know, my boss was let go, I was demoted. And that was when the narrative changed. Like I told you, I didn't have to deal with those stigmas like coming up in scouting, but then immediately once I was hired, but even before then, I was, hey, here's that analytic, you know, that analytics guy that was, you know, part of that, you know, 1-31 experience.
Who was trying to hinky us.
Right. And so, like, you know, the industry perspective changed for me personally, and going through that stretch was really hard at times. And certainly the last year and a half I was in Cleveland, and, you know, it even followed me to Philadelphia. So when I got back here in the decision-making role, like I had been through enough adversity and like kind of personal career adversity where I wasn't really afraid of the worst case outcomes. Like, shoot, I just lived through 1-15, 0-16, a really difficult experience, a demotion, like, you know, a period where you're a little bit of like a pariah from industry standpoint. So like, I mean, get through that. Like I'm not really worried about making a decision that's like controversial if I think it's the right thing for the organization. So that part is not hard for me. I think the other challenge though is a lot of what we talk about from a decision-making standpoint is decision-making over time. Like a lot of what we talk about is being long run focused. And it's kind of like investing. You know, no fund manager has an indefinite time horizon, and neither do we, right? And I think that because in sports in general, it's emotional, right? It's emotional for fans, it's emotional for players, it's emotional for owners, it's emotional for, you know, coaching staff, front office staff. I think generally speaking, sports can be a little bit of impulsive. And at the end of the day, people look at win-loss record and outcome. And because of that, that can really, really drive decision-making because of that pressure that you alluded to, that you may not get, hey, this is a good strategy and it'll work over the course of 10 years. But unfortunately, if you get unlucky in the first three, or if it doesn't work out over the first three, like that can realistically, you know, still be a problem. And so I think fighting against kind of that natural inclination, because that is real pressure, but also understanding that like your decision-making strategies should adjust based on time horizon. Like that should be an input in terms of how you would, you know, how you would behave. Now that doesn't mean that everything should be so short-sighted and outcome-based, but there is a little bit of trade-off depending on where your team is or when you're expected to deliver a certain set of results.
Yeah. It's just interesting trying to think about how you strike the balance, right? Like, I made the joke about Hinkie, but it's a real problem, right? Mm-hmm. So tanking the 76ers, he wasn't around to see what the results of that were. Mm-hmm. Although it's very easy to track the lineage of those results, right? And obviously having a 10-year time horizon, well, we're not going to win for 10 years. Nobody's going to accept that. So, you know, how do you think about what the right balance is between the short and long-term time horizon, like as you're going into the draft, for example?
Yeah. So I think for me personally, number one, it depends on where the team is. So, right, where we are with what we believe is a young core coming off an 11-5 season, like we'll wait a little bit more generally with some of our decisions in terms of short-term results relative to, let's say, when I came into the organization in 2016, you know, when we had a roster that was older, it was very expensive, and it wasn't very good. Like all of that's going to be really shifted towards a longer term focus to build a sustained foundation. But when we're in a time where we think that we're in a window of contention, you know, we probably will make a few more short-term trade-offs relative to the long-term. Now that also depends on, from a general manager's seat, like let's talk about it from a roster building perspective. That'll depend on, okay, what mode of acquisition are we discussing? So you mentioned the draft. To me, the draft is all about more longer term asset management. And that's the mode of acquisition that allows you to build a sustainable foundation. So probably with very few exceptions, we will be a lot more long term focused as opposed to, hey, look, we need X now, you know, because we think we can be really competitive this year. That's what allows you to be competitive year over year. Now, free agency, there may be, or even from on the trade market, there may be certain bets that's like, okay, hey, we're a competitive team. In the past, we really wouldn't have like acquired players on shorter term deals who are older or towards the tail end of their career. Now, there may be a little bit of leniency depending on the role or depending on the player. Or, hey, we wouldn't be major players in this market because we just haven't built up our foundation. Now we may be able to kind of polish a few different sides of the ball because, you know, we are in a window where we do think that we're able to contend.
That's such an interesting way to think about it, the different modes of acquisition with what the time horizon is and how that interacts. So this makes me think about something. So, you know, you obviously came in and like magic.
Like magic. I wish it was like magic.
I know. For the first time in 18 years, the Browns made the playoffs. You had an 11-5 season. So you mentioned Sashi Brown, and it's sort of that tanking strategy. That doesn't mean, like, for people who don't know, it doesn't mean like losing on purpose. It means stripping your team down in order to build it for the longer run, right? So getting some focus on those longer term decisions, right? So, but those have to have time to play out. So how much would you say, like, if you're thinking about the success that you had coming in this year, what is the influence of what was happening on Sashi Brown in terms mm-hmm. of as you come in, the experience that you had this year with the success?
No, it's a great question, Andy, because I think oftentimes, whether it's fans, teams, whatever, would like to suggest that any outcome that happens in a given season is solely because of the decisions in that year. And that's not the case. So one thing I'll push back on, like, and I know, you know, Sashi's not on here to talk about it, but, you know, the strategy really wasn't tanking in 2016. We were certainly disappointed we didn't win more games, but you're right that part of the focus was on making sure that we could acquire and draft and have enough resources from a cap perspective that we could have a long-term sustainable build and keep a young core together. And I think the resources at the disposal of the team, the quantity and quality of picks, the cap space that was accumulated during Sashi's time has a huge impact on the success that the team is having today. And likewise, you know, not just Sashi, the general manager after him, you know, John Dorsey, deploying mm-hmm. some of those resources, all of those play a role in terms of the team's success. And I think it would be disingenuous to suggest that there wasn't some good done during that time period by people who were in the decision-making seat before I was. And I think that's true for every franchise.
Yeah. And I it's interesting just thinking about then how do you balance, you know, having that core built up, how do you balance those time horizons in terms of mm-hmm. the decisions that you're making, and how do you make sure that your approach is flexible so that you don't become someone who's just really focused on young talent or someone who's really focused on the proven entity, but you have a mixed strategy yeah. when it comes to that.
No, it's another great question, Annie. I think part of it is just making sure you keep the ultimate goal in mind. Like the goal at the end of the day is to win a Super Bowl. And depending on where you think you are on called the win curve, so to speak, will dictate some mix of short-term and long-term trade-off. Because I think it's easy to think about just like, hey, sustainability, or win now, when what makes the general manager's jobs both hard, but also very interesting and fun is that you really do have a foot in the present and a foot in the future. And
yeah.
whether hopefully you're never standing on one foot, but perhaps depending on how much weight you're putting on one or the other will depend on really where you are in your team's life cycle. So I always try, because like, as you could probably guess, I probably am, probably general managers in general are probably a little bit more like longer term focus, because many of us grew up thinking about the draft and, you know, young players and things along those lines. But I have to catch myself where it's like, hey, Andrew, like at times, like, especially if you have like a good team, hey, the goal is to win the Super Bowl. Like, let's not forget that the goal is to win the Super Bowl, not at all costs. You don't want to, you know, mortgage the, you know, the sustainability of the team, but the goal is to win the Super Bowl. And I think if you don't lose sight of that, that at least helps.
Oh, I love that. I love the way that like that kind of distilling of that particular problem. So one of the things that's really interesting is really back in the 70s. And I don't know if you're familiar with him, but there's a guy named Barry Staw he's done a whole bunch of really interesting work on something called escalation of commitment, also known as escalation traps. And it's a broader psychological phenomenon that would encompass the sunk cost fallacy, right? So for people who don't know, sunk cost is you have resources that you've spent on something. And the question is, do you want to continue in that endeavor? And when you're already in the losses, when you've already spent, you're just more likely to continue in the endeavor, even if that endeavor is failing. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's problems with that, because whatever dollar you spend to continue or time that you spend to continue, you could be doing on other things that might be more profitable. So this is a big football problem.
Yes.
Because every single time you choose to spend on a player and you have a salary cap, so you don't have unlimited resources, and the market, there are times that you can trade people, but not always. So you have this problem. And so he noticed this first in the NBA, was this very interesting phenomenon, which is that if you completely normalized for skill, so you took two players who were exactly identical in skill, and one was a very high draft pick and the other wasn't, that what would happen is that the high draft pick would get much more playing time and actually be much less likely to be traded. So they would stay on the team longer. Now, again, I'm saying they're totally equally skilled players. And obviously you can see even bigger things like that. Like, let's say they're a high draft pick and you've traded away a bunch of draft picks to get them. So you've traded your way up mm-hmm. to get them. And this has then since been replicated in the NFL. So we see this problem in the NFL, and this obviously creates a problem in terms of trading and how are you thinking about playtime? And maybe in the back of my head, Carson Wentz is in the back of my head here. I don't know. I'm from Philly. I can't help it. So I'm just interested in like, how do you think about those kinds of problems? Because obviously this type of problem of sunk cost and endowment and escalation of commitment have such a big effect on the way you're managing your salary cap and the way you're managing free agency and trading. And I'm wondering just how have you been thinking in this particular area about how to get more rational about what the value of a player is, regardless of whether they are presently on your roster or not?
It's a very hard challenge for teams and decision makers because you're right. It's not even just what you invest financially or in terms of draft capital, but what you invest emotionally or mentally into the decision, and you want to give it every chance to work out. So before I answer your question directly, the one area, and this may be just the scout in me, that I think part of the reason, so certainly part of the reason is this, you know, dynamic we're talking about, just the sunk cost dynamic. But I also do think that they're part of it is like you can have two equally skilled players, and with the higher draft pick, usually maybe they're the better physical talent. So there is a higher, at least perceived higher upside as that, call it, player develops over time. That may not be tied to the cost of acquiring. Now, I think it's a fair question whether we as an industry measure upside, you know, accurately or well. But just to defend us emotional decision makers and us as scouts, I would be remiss if I didn't at least say that.
Let me just say though, this isn't an emotional decision. This is a problem for this. Yeah. There is not a single human being who doesn't have this issue, right? Like, you know, you've invested in something and you refuse to sell because you're behind. I saw this in poker all the time. You know, people would be in a poker game and they'd be losing and someone would come up and say, hey, it's our anniversary. We had a dinner date tonight. And they'd be like, no, this is the best game I ever played in. I'm sorry, we're going to have to postpone our anniversary till tomorrow night. Right. So it's a similar kind of problem. Right. So these kinds of issues of how do you think rationally about when you're supposed to let go of something? Mm-hmm. You know, they're just really hard. And I just am thinking about the NFL that this problem comes up repeatedly. Yeah. Because you have free agency, mm-hmm. you know, so on and so forth. You're trading draft picks up and down.
No, so it certainly does. So there are a couple of things that, you know, that we try to do, and by no means are we perfect in this area. By no means am I perfect in this area. So I think number one, let's talk about just like the emotion piece. One is trying to do the hardcore analysis, decision-making, remove from, call it, the emotion of the season, the emotion of the player, the emotion of the decision. Like, and that may sound simple, but like the offseason comes quickly in the NFL, and it can be easy to just like think of the last thing that happened in the season or, you know, something along those lines and just not have enough distance from a moment that will always stick in your mind regarding a particular player. I think the second part is getting a number of independent perspectives and letting those independent perspectives essentially state their case, speak their mind. Because it's easy as a decision maker just to be so much in your own cocoon that you're thinking about only your viewpoint on the player. So whether that's if you're making a free agency decision, individual evaluations from your pro scouting group, or the individual evaluations from your research and strategy group, or the individual evaluations from your coaching staff, because usually that gives you a fair analysis, you know, with, or at least taking out some of the bias. Now, there will always probably be some organizational bias because it's easy for people to, when you're living with a player day to day, be clouded by what kind of everyone's saying in the building. But usually that helps out a little bit. The other thing is like, we do have a lot of good objective data internally that it's kind of like, all right, as much as I may like, or let's say dislike what I've seen or what has happened recently with, you know, with an individual player on the roster, it's a good anchor where it's like, all right, well, this really isn't biased, or this is largely unbiased. And then really the last thing that we try and do, we do actually try to have a third party perspective. So there are actually a couple, you know, things that we use that aren't in our building, because as much as you want to try and like weed out every type of bias with all of your internal evaluation methods, that's probably to some degree a bit impossible, or at least a bit challenging. And so it's really taking into account all those perspectives and maybe digging in where those perspectives disagree to make sure that you actually get to truth. But the only way that we can do that, or maybe I should just speak for myself, the only way that I can do that is if I'm removed from the emotional decision. So if it tells me something that I really don't want to hear, I can taken in and ultimately make the best decision for the organization, as opposed to something that's going to just satisfy me or satisfy my desires.
Yeah, so I love that. So you said two things in there that I think are so great. I mean, so one of the things is that Barry Staw, who I mentioned before, one of the things he mentions is that if you have a different person make the decision about quitting or stopping whatever you're doing, then the person who made the decision to start, you do better. And it sounds like you do that by getting a third party perspective.
Yeah.
Someone who doesn't like have ownership over the original decision, like it's not their baby, you know, that decision. So I love that you're doing that. But the other that you mentioned is just getting a lot of eyes on it. You know, what are the different perspectives and kind of going, you know, with the campaign that you launched called Be the Solution. I've heard you talk so passionately about the relationship between diversity from a social justice perspective, but also diversity from a decision-making perspective and the way those things play together. And I'd love to understand, first of all, you know, what Be the Solution is, and then, you know, get your thoughts on the way that those play together and why we should really care about that.
Yeah. So, you know, Be the Solution is a campaign that we launched really in the wake of George Floyd's death, when the entire country was dealing with just really social unrest. And what, you know, I found, like, it had a pretty strong effect. It had a very strong effect on me, and it had a very strong effect on a number of people, you know, within our organization. But the thing that I actually found is, like, a lot of people wanted to either do something or truly understand why so many people across the country were so passionate, but didn't really know where to start or like how to get involved. And so where we were fortunate, just with the platform that we have as an NFL organization, and the support that we have from, you know, our ownership group, the Haslam family, is we were able to really use our platform to provide people a way to get educated, provide them the resources, whether it was with, you know, books, podcasts, you know, videos, you know, you name it, documentaries, but then also have specific ways that they could get actively involved socially, really across our, you know, our city of Cleveland. And I'm really proud because, you know, our organization has really, you know, been at the forefront of this, and people have gotten engaged, and it's been something that's been healthy for, you know, for our city, and just really in hopes of, you know, doing something good, using our platform to do something good. To your second question, Andy, about just really the value of diversity, I don't think that people often stop enough to think about, like, why, you know, why it's important, and then also really what, you know, diversity really means. And for us, it's, let's take it from a pure, take out maybe the ethical considerations, like just pure utilitarian from a business perspective. I think it helps teams make better decisions, like no different than we talked about the different perspectives from our scouts or coaches or analysts. Because diversity, I think people oftentimes just focus on race, and like demographic diversity is important, whether it's race or gender or, you know, age, you name it, because that oftentimes shapes our experiences and perspectives. And that's really what you're trying to grab. But experiential diversity, whether it's, you know, someone who's been in the business for a long time or has been short, or they've just had different experiences within the business, and then cognitive diversity, how people actually think, that, like, all three of those are important. And that's really what we strive to do when we hire organizations, and ultimately when we bring people to the decision-making table, because that's what allows us to, you'll probably never eliminate all blind spots as a decision maker, but we at least try to eliminate as many as possible. And that's at least been an effective way to do that, you know, for us.
Yeah. I love that perspective, the way that you can think about the, you know, marrying the social justice issue with, you know, the cognitive diversity issue, and think about diversity from many different angles, I guess, from many diverse angles, and the way that creates a sort of completes a picture of great decision making. So just one last thing before I get to our closing questions. I heard you on Hustle and Flow, which was amazing, by the way. Everybody should go listen to that podcast. You were so great on it. And you said something that really, really caught my eye or my ear, I guess, because I was listening, that I thought was so great, which was they asked you, you know, how you dealt with this particular season, which is, I think, just so, you know, difficult. It was so difficult in so many different ways because, you know, you'd wake up in the morning and wouldn't necessarily know what your roster was going to be because of COVID. And now thinking further about the way you take that uncertainty into for example, this year's draft, right, where obviously the college season itself, like where you would have been scouting from, has been quite strange. And I thought your answer was so interesting and so insightful, which was, I'm going to paraphrase it really shortly, and then I'd love for you to elaborate, which was, well, it's not really different than any decisions that I'm having to make, even when it's not COVID. I found that incredibly deep. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that and why we should, why my ears were perking up there.
Yeah, I guess part of it is, so if I could define the general manager's job into two things, it would be crisis management and decision-making under uncertainty. Just the forms that those take differ from year to year or week to week or quite unfortunately day to day. But it's the same principles. Like it's you know, we talk about computer science. It's kind of like the idea of abstraction. It's like the mm-hmm. same process or same situations or same general, you know, principles, but this, like the situation is different. And so, you know, one thing that our chief strategy officer, I remember he said this years ago, he goes like, you know, at some point, like decision makers in sports, they just have to get uncomfortable with being uncomfortable comfortable with being uncomfortable. And it's so true. Like it's so true. And so, you know, people always assume that, okay, hey, COVID's gone, your life's going to be so much easier, you know, everything's going to be downhill. And it's like, no, that's not going to be the case. If it's not COVID, it's going to be something else, whether it's an injury situation, a staffing situation, you know, some other, it could be like a weather-related emergency, a trout, like you just don't know what it's going to be. But a lot of the ways that you handle crisis and then decision-making under uncertainty in a year where you were, the primary thing was COVID and the roster and something along those lines will apply to a year where, like this offseason, where, hey, we didn't know what the salary cap was going to be until, you know, a couple of days before the league year. And although those are two different problems, the lack of full information that you had is similar. And, you know, you still have to do your best to make the right decision with it anyway.
Yeah, so my ears really perked up to that, because one of the things that I've been saying is, basically, when you look across a lot of the cognitive biases that really frustrate our decision making, a lot of them have to do with being sort of overly certain, right? Like too certain than the world would actually tell you to be, whether it's overconfidence, illusion of control. You know, we think we sort of have more control over our own destinies, that the world is more predictable than it actually is. And that what COVID has done is essentially forced you to stop pretending. To some degree, I mean, we're still overconfident, but stop pretending. It's like you had blinders on to the uncertainty, and then COVID came along and just sort of took them off for a second. And now, as soon as, you know, we're all vaccinated, we're back out, everyone's going to put those blinders on. And so that's why I loved what you said, is that your point was, it's not really much different. It's just that you might be seeing it more, but it's always there. And that's the whole point, is that you have to get comfortable with the world as it actually is. Exactly. And take a lesson from this moment where you couldn't pretend.
That's 100% accurate, Annie. 100% accurate.
Well, so, I mean, I just, you know, sometimes I heard something and I went, oh, that's so good. I love that. You know, to be fair, just full disclosure, partly because I've sort of been saying that. So I was very excited to hear my point of view parroted back at me, which is something all human beings really enjoy. Okay, so again, I just want to ask you this. First of all, let me just say, like, this has been incredible. Like I, this is such a great conversation. It's very clear why you're the youngest GM in football history. And just in terms of being able to get into your mind and the way you think about these decisions and how thoughtful you are in framing and thinking about different time horizons and the interaction between sort of heart and head. And so anyway, I just want to just tell you how grateful I am for this conversation. So just pivoting a little bit to the Alliance itself. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were to think about, you know, the mission of the Alliance, which is to obviously empower every student with decision skills, right? So it, in the same way that we think about empowering them with social emotional skills and also apparently trigonometry skills. But let's say that we were to succeed in empowering them with decision skills. What would you expect? Like, how would you expect society to look different?
I actually think the biggest challenge, like as we bring kids up, we really tell them what to do or what to think, as opposed to like how to think and how to make decisions. And I think that ends up bleeding into society where it's almost a little bit like what we were talking about a little bit earlier with the idea of certainty. You're like, hey, this is how things are done, or we almost operate in a world where we think it's a deterministic environment when it's like completely the opposite of that. I think you probably have a more fast changing society, like from the perspective, I don't think people will be indoctrinated into, you know, tradition or ways things have been done in the past. I think they'd evolve more quickly with the pace of the world. I also think, quite honestly, you'd have more respectable dialogue back and forth because people would be aware of their own biases and just the inherent uncertainty with a belief, a decision, or just a general problem. Because I think overconfidence, like, it's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge in the business world. It's a huge challenge in society. And I think a big part of better decision making is understanding how uncertain most environments are. And I think that would actually lead to better discourse overall.
Yeah, I love what you said about that, because I think, you know, we have this tendency to think that if somebody holds a different point of view than we do, that they're evil. And then you have this very strange, like, Hanlon's razor, which is never attribute to malice what you can attribute to stupidity. And I'm like, well, I don't know that that's any better. Like, why not just someone can hold different points of view than you are for totally rational reasons, or you know, a mix. And we should be open-minded to listening to what they say. And obviously there are boundaries to that. There, no question. But I hear what you're saying about, you know, we might be more respectful in the way that we interacted with each other in a way that would be more healthy for society. As you're thinking about your job now as GM, and you think about the players coming onto your team, and then obviously there's so many different roles that you're having to fill across the organization. Can you think about, like, what's the one decision-making tool or idea or strategy that if you could sort of magically have out there in the world would just improve your ability to have really great quality decision makers in your organization?
Is this something that actually has to exist from a process standpoint, or my dream?
You get to dream it up.
If we had whether it was a machine or we could, like, a pill where you could eliminate confirmation bias, that would be the number one thing that I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I say that largely because I know I have a problem with that, but I think it's one of the things and I see it all the time in football, but I think that's a really, like, I go into every draft process. I go into every draft process knowing that I have to, like, actively fight against that for myself. And then just as you get more information, the overcompensation, the uncertainty, you just try and apply it to the view that you've taken. If there was a way to, like, completely eliminate that bias, I would sign up for it and spread it all across the organization.
What book, is there a particular book you might recommend to listeners that would help improve their decision-making?
That's a good one. Probably Thinking Fast and Slow. That was good. I listened to that one on audio probably my last year in Indianapolis, and it just was rich in content, but I don't know, it just kind of made me more conscious of when I was using, like, the difference, or try to be more conscious of how I was using the different systems in my brain and just trying to be a little bit more thoughtful and deliberate in my own thought processes.
Well, we'll make sure that Thinking Fast and Slow is linked in the show notes for everybody to go read the Kahneman, that Kahneman book, which is so amazing. Okay. Last question, and then I'd love to for listeners to be able to know where they can go find you. So, you know, I was way back when, you probably didn't think I was listening to her, but I was, about your parents. And I'm just curious, was there, like, some sort of family explosion, like a huge fight that occurred between your Cowboys loving father and you in Philadelphia all of a sudden? Because I would just like to say, I know from being in Philadelphia, we're talking about a bitter rivalry here.
No, and that was the bitterest of all bitter rivals in the NFCs for my dad, because he had actually worked in Philadelphia when we were young as a Cowboys fan, and he was in the news business. So it was tough sledding. At that point, he was a fan of his son. I'm sure he won't admit it. I'm sure a little piece of him died, but he was all Eagles gear that entire year. Now, I will say this, now I'm with the Browns, he's back to his Cowboys stuff, but it's not Browns related, but he was a great fan and supporter of his son the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that for either Eagles or Cowboys fans, if you were to make a bet, and the bet was, like, an Eagles fan has to go wear Cowboys Cowboys gear to a game or vice versa, that, like, that would be so much worse than betting, like, $2,000 on the game, right? That, like, no, I'll pay the money.
That's 100% right. So I'll tell you the funny thing, Andy, is as much as my dad was all Eagles all the time, I did have some relatives on his side of the family. They were like, love my, you know, grandson, love my nephew, but we'll root for him for every game but the two that they played the Cowboys during the year.
There you go.
So they say blood's thicker than water, but I'm not quite sure that falls with
but
sports.
Not thicker than football. It's not thicker than football, apparently, in some cases. Yeah, that's what I was curious about. All right, so if listeners want to go online and find out more about you, more about the Browns, particularly more about Be the Solution, mm-hmm. can you let them know where they might find you, follow you on social media, et cetera?
So unfortunately, I'm not a social media guy, so I don't.
No,
I
that's
don't,
probably fortunately for you. So I don't. Not for us, but for you.
So I'm not, you know, Facebook, Instagram, anything along those lines.
You can go to the social media sites where you won't find Andrew, and you can hit hashtag Be the Solution, and you'll find that. And obviously, we'll link to all of that in the show notes for people who are really interested in getting involved with that, so that they can feel like they're doing something and contributing. Perfect. That's amazing. Well, listen, I am so excited to have gotten the time to speak with you. All the stuff that we talked about, again, it's going to be linked in the show notes. You'll be able to get a transcript of today. And Andrew, I'm just every conversation that I have with you, I feel like I learned so much from you.
The feeling is mutual. I can sure I learn a lot more from you than you learn from me.
Well, I don't know about that, but I so appreciate you taking the time out. I know this is a really busy time, so thank you so much for having this conversation with us.
No, I appreciate you, Annie, and thank you for having me on.
At the Alliance for Decision Education, our mission is to improve lives by empowering students with essential decision skills. We're building a national movement to ensure decision education is part of every student's learning experience. Through this podcast, we're raising awareness about the movement, but we need your help. Please share, tweet, and sign the pledge on our website, alliancefordecisioneducation.org. If there's someone you think would be great for us to interview for a future episode, or if you have a question about decision-making that you'd like us to explore on the podcast, email us at connect@alliancefordecisioneducation.org. For listeners interested in following up on any of the materials mentioned today, check out the show notes on the Alliance site, where you'll also find a transcript of today's conversation. Ratings on Apple Podcasts are always greatly appreciated, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast in your favorite app so that you don't miss an episode. Thank you, and I hope you join us again soon.